So, Rich, a few weeks ago, started a series on the Sigillavada Sutta, and I'm going to follow up somewhat with it, but not entirely, and I'll explain that. I'm doing some research right now, and the research is basically what householders back in the Buddha's time became enlightened, and did they all follow the monastic routine that the Buddha laid out to get enlightened, or if they only went as far as practicing the precepts, what took place then? Did anybody start on the road to enlightenment? So I talked to my teacher, Gil Fronsdale, about it. He said, sounds like a good one to look into. So this talk is kind of what I have found out so far, and I'm really just starting research. So bear with me. So, and I'm also going to be speaking rather from an orthodox Theravadan point of view, because the research I have to do has to be sutta research, so the answers has to come from the suttas as well. So I can't use contemporary language, although at the end I'll give you a contemporary breakdown of what I think of all of this, but I'm going to be using more orthodox language. And it's also a little bit easier right now to do that because Laura and I both went on the Saranaloka monastic retreat over New Year's. It was an 8-day retreat, and you live like a monastic, and you hear chanting coming straight from the Pali Canon, and it's very orthodox, and you kind of get steeped in that, you know, whether you want to or not. It just kind of pervades you. What I am finding out in the research that I've done so far is there is no consistent pattern of how the Buddha taught lay people on this is what you do along the path like he did monastics. It varied from individual to individual, depended on where they were on the path, and with his divine eye, he could see a lot of things about where they were on the path and would give them directions. So he had various instructions for various people. Bhikkhu Bodhi said the Dhamma fills three functions. And this is from his book, in the Buddha's own words. Welfare and happiness directly visible in this present life, attained by fulfilling one's moral commitments and social responsibilities. Welfare and happiness pertaining to the next life, which we could take as the future also, attained by engaging in meritorious deeds. And then finally, the ultimate good or supreme goal of nibbana, final release from the cycle of rebirths. So why I was interested in pursuing this, it came out of observations from prisoners. And about 3 years ago, there was a group of prisoners that we had, and Joette spent time with them as well, that were very, very dedicated. So dedicated that I almost had a 5-day residential retreat in prison planned. If a realignment hadn't happened and everybody got transferred, we would have had a residential retreat in prison. Their primary practice was virtuous conduct. They loved talking about the precepts, they loved discussing the precepts, they practiced the precepts, and we all saw remarkable changes in them over 7 years. I mean, remarkable changes. And also people in this Sangha, I am sure there are many of you, you come on Thursday nights to sit and meditate because you don't do it during the week. I won't ask, but I am sure there's many of you that's the case. Meditation can be very difficult, but it is the practice we should be following, but a lot of us don't do it. Yet, and there's people that I mentor, and I see what a difference it has made by their following the precepts, how much happier they are, how they're paying attention to their lives, how they're being mindful of their lives and what they're doing in society and with the way they're conducting their own life. So that's why I was interested in this. Okay, these people seem to really be coming a long ways. What did the Buddha have to say about that? People who this was their primary practice. So I'm going to back up again and go back to Orthodox Theravadan descriptions of the four-step process that takes you to Nibbana. Okay, this is how the Buddha described it in the very orthodox point of view. And the first step in achieving complete awakening is called a stream enter. And the stream enter is completely free of identity view. Essentially, your ego is not there. It's no longer all about you. They're not attached to rites and rituals. And there is no longer any doubt about the teachings. So this is the first step on this path to enlightenment. The second step traditionally is called a once returner. And the once returner has greatly attenuated or started to overcome sensual desire and ill will. They haven't completely, but they're starting to get over it. Sensual desire and ill will. Just wanting, grasping, and not wanting, take it away. The non-returner has completely gotten over the first three that I mentioned and sensual desire and ill will. And then finally, the arahant, which is what the Buddha was, and many of his monastics became arahants. They have completely gotten rid of the first five fetters, and the final five are craving for fine material existence, craving for existence on the level of formlessness, all conceit, all restlessness, and all ignorance. And that is an awakened person. So along that continuum, where would a person who has got the rudimentary but essential practice of virtuous conduct? And remember, in our practice, in the Buddhist practice, there's three trainings. The first is virtuous conduct. That's what we start with. Ethical conduct, generally described as the five precepts. The second is samadhi, or meditation, a meditation practice. And the third is vipassana, insight into the way things are. I like to think that the first two lead into the third. And maybe that's how it's taught, but I'm never sure. So, and then I started thinking, imagine if everybody in society just practiced the precepts. That's it. That's all they practiced. Remember, the precepts are to undertake the training of not killing or harming a living being, to not take what is not freely given, to not engage in sexual misconduct, to refrain from lying, and to refrain from intoxicants that lead to heedlessness. Imagine if that's all anybody ever did in society. I think that'd be enough. I think it would be a great society. So, in doing this research, I wanted to see how often did the Buddha talk to lay people versus monastics. How many of his teachings were geared towards householders, people like us, who are not living the completely solitary, homeless life of a monastic. And I found this man, John Kelly, who was actually a researcher for Bhikkhu Bodhi, the great teacher who's written and translated so much of the Pali Canon. And John Kelly did some research with the five books in the Sutta Pitaka, and he said that 90% of the time the Buddha spoke to monastics. He counted all the suttas, all the talks. And the Anguttara Nikaya, which is one of the books in the Pali Canon, is where the Buddha most frequently talked to lay people. and 40% of the talks in there were to lay people. So, virtuous conduct. As Rich pointed out when he gave his talk a few weeks ago, the epicenter of virtuous conduct, the vinaya for householders, vinaya meaning code of ethic, is the Sigalavata Sutta. It is, I believe, and I could be wrong, the first place where the five precepts are laid out. It's actually laid out in four precepts, with the fifth one taking on a different tone, but you get the idea. I also found something very interesting. If I can look this up quickly, the Sigalavata, you can get an ebook version of it, and it has pictures. It's a picture book. And it's great. And all you have to do is go to Buddha.net or BuddhaNet.net, and you can get this book. So, you can see it's got a picture book. It's for kids. And it lays out the sutta in very interesting, simple language. I read it a couple times. I got it way easier after reading this little picture book. So, BuddhaNet.net, just go to the Sigalavata Sutta, and you can download it. So I highly recommend it. It's very good. So Rich had summarized it quite well a few weeks ago. I'm not going to go over the whole thing, but very, very generally. And then I'm just going to touch on one section. Rich bravely said he's going to be touching on the section on women, which I don't want to miss that. I don't even want to touch that section. We have to remember that the Buddha was also a product of this culture. You know, even though he was an enlightened being, he was still a cultural being. And even reading the part on women, which tends to have a misogynistic tone to it, it's also probably very liberating for women at that time. Women were pretty much considered slaves, had no rights. And what he was saying, you know, offering respect, making sure that she was cared for, that kind of thing, you know, was probably pretty liberating in its time. But anyway, in the Sigalavata Sutta, it starts off with a young man, and it says he was wet of hair and skin, and he was about to worship in the six directions. And most likely being wet of hair and skin means he was doing some kind of ritual, you know, where you washed yourself off, wet your hair. And he was praying in the six directions, northeast, southwest, up and down. And the Buddha, as he was wont to do, took this probably Brahmin type ritual and turned it over and said, that's not going to help anything. That praying is not going to help anything. You're not going to change anything by praying to the north, south, east, west, up and down. And Sigalavata said, so what do I do? And the Buddha gave him some instructions. And one of the first things he said was, you need to remove the five evil actions. And these could be construed as the precepts that I just recited, which come from four evil motives: greed, aversion, ignorance, and fear. We've all heard about greed, aversion, and doubt, but this one considers the fourth also, fear, which is interesting. And he goes into, you don't spend your wealth stupidly. You observe the four quarters like this. The east are your parents. And then he goes into, and if you get this kid's book, it's great because it just goes into all the steps that you need as a good person to observe when you're a child and you're looking after your parents. And then what children need to do and what parents need to do. And then the same with teachers, with friends, companions, with servants, and religious teachers. And he ended up saying, by following this, it'll create harmony and love in society. So I gave this talk, actually a very modified talk, at Folsom Prison the other night, and I decided to talk about friends because I thought most of these male inmates would relate more to that section than any other. And it was really a very good discussion when I did that, especially the very first word that is used in this little book for kids, which I can't believe, where the Buddha says, he classifies one sort, one type of friend as rapacious. Now, I asked them, anybody know what rapacious means? I didn't. I had to look it up. I like the word. I sound really intelligent by saying it, but I had no idea what it meant. And rapacious, does anybody here know what it means?
Like the hungry ghost, it's just feeding.
Greedy.
Yeah,
it's greedy.
Greedy, right. Greedy. Exceptionally greedy and selfish. Exceptionally, that's right. So we have some very well-read people here. And so the Buddha then goes into, he has four types of rapacious people, and then he has four types of who he calls the helper. So I'm going to briefly go over the rapacious and then briefly go over the helper. And so this is advice on the kind of people you seek out and the kind of people you do not want to hang with. So the rapacious person, and he divided this up into four categories. I just put it all into one just because I felt like it. So the rapacious person gives little and expects much. He helps out only when it benefits him, and he's only interested in himself. He talks about himself. He tries to win you over with flattery. And when you ask him to help, there's always a reason why he can't. He encourages you to do wrong. He'll praise you to your face and gossip about you as soon as he's with others. He gets drunk with you. He encourages you to gamble. And he encourages you to stay out late. This does not sound like a good person to hang out with. And I think this also, I thought it's interesting, it seems to go beyond cultural sensitivity. I mean, this sounds pretty useful, you know, no matter what culture we're in. And then he goes into the helper. The helper, well, the Buddha didn't use this word, but he has your back. He takes care of your property if you're busy. You happen to be doing something else, he makes sure everything's okay. He's a refuge when you are afraid. He readily helps you out. He is honest with you and doesn't share what you confide in him. He is there for you even when you get in trouble. He would even die for you. He always restrains you from doing wrong. And I love this next one. He reminds you of signs you may be ignoring. And I think we've all been in that place where we see what's going on and maybe our friend doesn't. And do we say something or not? Is our friend going to take it the right way? But according to the Buddha, this is when we should be alerting people if we're a true friend. He reveals to you the way to heaven. He rejoices with your prosperity and he admires those who praise you. And he'll walk away from anyone who speaks ill of you. It's a pretty good definition of a friend. Good advice. And then the Buddha goes through this same listing with all the other categories of parents, kids, teachers, etc., etc. So I'm interested in, okay, so how far do you get in your enlightenment journey by following the Sigalavada Sutta and doing everything it says in there? And actually the Buddha answers it in the sutta himself. The sutta states that by practicing precepts and these guidelines in your lifetime, you will be reborn in the Deva realm. Now that sounds good. Deva realm sounds good, but you're not liberated. in the Deva realm, everything is pleasant, and you live a long time, but you're not done. And you need to come back as a human to become liberated. So you'll have a good time for a while. But this is not going to lead to liberation. However, I believe I read that you can never be born as anything except a human again. I think I read that. Doug or Rich, please, that is correct? Thank you. So that's a good place to be, but you're not liberated. So other suttas address the householder and on the road to liberation in terms of merit. And I think we've all heard merit, and sometimes we've offered merit here after we've sat and listened to a Dhamma talk and offering the merit to all beings. And the Buddha described it in a variety of ways depending on who he was speaking to. So the principal virtues a lay person should follow leading to future welfare are, the first one is generosity. Dana, practicing dana, is the first thing that the Buddha said we should be doing as lay people, and that increases merit. Moral discipline, and this is the five precepts. Faith is the next one. In some of the suttas, and like I said previously, this isn't always the same. He gave different directions to different people. I found this to be a more recurring theme. Faith in the Buddha as an enlightened person, and faith in your own ability to become enlightened, that it can take place. And wisdom. And wisdom is defined as insight into the arising and passing away of all phenomena. So according to Bhikkhu Bodhi, for early Buddhism, the ideal householder is not merely a devout supporter of the monastic order, but a noble person who has attained at least the first of the four stages of realization, the fruition of stream entry. And then the last one is meditation, bhavana, as a base for merit. And for householders, in many of the suttas, it is stressing the cultivation of the Brahmaviharas, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So the Anguttara Nikaya is where most of the suttas for householders are found. And many times the Buddha calls it streams of merit. And the Buddha said in some of the suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya, he saw a real advantage for doing well in this life for lay people, for doing well, for making money, for being prosperous. He says that, and I'm paraphrasing, while practicing the way to liberation, they must avoid a rebirth in the unfortunate realm and win successive rebirths blessed with material security, happiness, and opportunities for further spiritual growth. So householders through karma and merit, through skillful actions of generosity, kindness, and wisdom, counter greed, aversion, and doubt. And then the last element, the last function for lay people, for moving on towards enlightenment, is our karma. And there's three kinds of karma. At least that's my belief, and I could be wrong, and somebody who's more steeped in this than me can correct me. But weighty karma is the karma that has been going on from past lifetimes to this lifetime. It's very orthodox Theravadan practice, why your proclivity is the way it is, why you're drawn to certain people or certain types of behavior. This is called weighty karma. Habitual karma is what we're learning in this lifetime, the way we act, the way we habitually respond. And then one very important one, and one we talk about in the Year to Live group, is near-death karma. And this is the karma that we have as we die, the kind of state of mind we're in the dying process. So those are the three kinds. And there is a layperson who actually, according to John Kelly's research, there were 19 people in Buddha Nikaya, in that one book in the Pali Canon, who 19 lay people who achieved enlightenment. And one of them is Anatha Pindika. And he is quite well known. Well, those of you who have, you know, been listening to Dharma talks here or read suttas, a lot of them start out with, "Thus I have heard, one time the Blessed One was staying at Savatthi in the Jetta Grove in Anatha Pindika's monastery." So this was a very wealthy Brahmin, and he is spoken of in more suttas as a layperson than any other else other than King Pasenadi. And he was the richest merchant in Savatthi. Some of you who had been to India remember going to Savatthi. And how he met the Buddha was interesting. He went over to his brother-in-law's house, and his brother-in-law had this great feast prepared, and usually Anatha Pindika was formally, taken out for a fine dinner or something. Nobody paid attention to him. They seemed to be waiting for someone else to show up. And it turns out the Buddha was going to visit. And Anatha Pindika said, "Well, who is this guy?" And his brother-in-law said, "He's the enlightened one." And Anatha Pindika immediately felt his heart opening. And he realized this is what he had been waiting for. That night he had a dream. He had a dream that he met the Buddha. And the dream was so lifelike that he went outside and started wandering the grounds around his palatial estate. And there was the Buddha standing there in reality. And Anatha Pindika wasn't sure what to say, so he just said, "So how are you?" And the Buddha said, "Well, I'm an arahant, so I'm always okay," which I think is a great answer. Arahants are always happy, and we don't suffer anymore, so everything's fine. And then he gave Anatha Pindika a Dharma talk. And at that moment, Anatha Pindika achieved stream entry. And his life was completely different. Now, this could be called weighty karma. You know, all this past karma that he had it led up to this point. So all it took, well, I guess any of us might become enlightened if we had a Buddha right in front of us looking at us, giving us a Dharma talk, which is why I'm sure why so many people were enlightened back then, but it happened to him immediately. So he was so taken with the Buddha, he decided to buy land and a monastery for him. And I think this has been mentioned in other talks, but it's very interesting. He went to Prince Jetta and said, "I want to buy that really nice piece of property you've got with all those nice trees and everything. It's beautiful." And Prince Jetta said, "Only if you can cover that whole," and I think it was something like 17 acres, "with gold. Every bit of it with gold pieces." And he said, "Okay." And he did. And so that piece of property then was given happily by Anatha Pindika to the Buddha. And that's where he stayed for, I believe it was 19 rains retreats. And there's many stories in the Anguttara Nikaya about Anatha Pindika and how advanced he was as a practitioner. Although not as a monastic, he only achieved stream entry, not complete enlightenment. He didn't go the whole way. And the Buddha said he couldn't because he had not lived as a monastic. Perhaps in the next lifetime he would. But lots of interesting things. One that I'll mention is King Pasanadi became quite jealous of Anathapindika because the Buddha was spending so much time at his monastery, and the king was, you know, given all kinds of money too, and he wanted the Buddha's attention. So he told his couriers and servants, every time the Buddha and the 500 monks that come with him, I want you to serve them the best meal ever. I want them to be so impressed with this great food. I want to get lots of merit from this. And so so they did. And he found out when the monks came, they took the food, they took it back to the village, and they gave it to all the lay people in the village to give back to them. And King Pasenadi was, oh, what's going on here? Why are they doing that? And the Buddha explained, giving with that kind of heart, couriers who are and servants who are just giving it just to show how much you've got, there's nothing to it. It is meaningless. I would rather have gruel and next to nothing from someone who is giving from their heart than these riches, this rich meal that you're giving us that is not coming from the heart. And he said, an example of the person who knows how to do this is Anathapindika. He serves from the heart. So, and then, long story short, Anathapindika, who was very, very wealthy, lost his fortune completely. And by a miracle, it came back. I'm not going to go into the whole miracle, but it all came back again, and he was absolutely amazed that he got his fortune back. And he asked, why did this happen? Why did I get this fortune back? And the Buddha said, and I think this is really interesting. Let me see if I can find it. The reason he got this back was he had followed virtuous conduct, and that would lead him to Nibbana. And I can't find the exact quote here, but I remember thinking, well, this is not according to what is supposed to be taking place. But he said this, the way you are acting and the way that you have been practicing, you will achieve Nibbana. And didn't even go into bhavana or samadhi. So this is why I think we have to take it by a case-by-case basis. Anathapindika was well on the road and perhaps didn't need to do this anymore. Weighty karma, on the other hand, you know the story of Angulimala. Angulimala also had weighty karma. And so even though he was a serial killer and killed 999 people, his weighty karma must have been very, very good, because as soon as he saw the Buddha, he also became fully enlightened. And then he had to go into villages and get stoned, and people would, you know, make his life miserable. Well, who wouldn't make somebody's life miserable who had killed 999 people? And when he came back and told the Buddha, this is horrible, what's happening to me? And the Buddha said, bear it. That's it. That's my advice to you. Bear it. Conclusion after just this little bit of research I did is, at the minimum, a lay follower who is virtuous in conduct and practices dana, and assuming the karmic fruits have been played out, he will achieve rebirth in the Deva realm just by practicing virtuous conduct, no samadhi. And he will always be born a human being, which is the most advantageous realm to be born in. And even though the karma karma may be such that even leading a life of non-virtue, as Angulimala, the weighty good karma will cause enlightenment. So that's another way of doing it. A dedicated householder, such as Anatha Pindika, achieves stream entry through weighted karma and through his own practice. He developed all three practices, both virtuous conduct, meditation, and wisdom. And on one occasion, the Buddha even said of him, he was more qualified to teach than some of the monastics. And he would send monastics to listen to Anatha Pindika. So the Buddha tailored his advice according to the individual. There is not, and this is according to Bhikkhu Bodhi, we do not find a single sutta, a single discourse in which the Buddha has drawn together all the elements of his teaching and assigned them to the appropriate place within some comprehensive system that a householder can follow. So, there you go. We're all individuals, and we need to do what we need to do, and we each have to figure that out. I think, it doesn't matter what I think. So, contemporary considerations. As I mentioned, Laura and I were at this monastic retreat, and the very first talk that was given was by Aya Santachitta, who is my teacher and a dear friend. I love spending time with her. And I almost memorized verbatim what she had to say because I had been thinking about starting this research paper. And this is what she said at the very beginning. The precepts are foundational. The first precept especially. By practicing this precept, you realize that just like you, other beings wish to be safe from harm. This creates an understanding of interconnectedness which diminishes the sense of an isolated self. I think you can go far with the precepts, looking at it that way, where the individual self isn't that part of the goal to realize anatta, no individual and changing self. And that, to me, indicates by practicing over and over again with the first precept, that's possible. And the Buddha himself always emphasized over and over again that freedom is available when we can see through the illusion of self. I see merit as engaging in the world, not necessarily as defined in the Pali Canon, but actually seeing what's taking place in the world. The karma of the world and what can we do about it. Seeing wrongs and taking opposing action. Doing what we can. And I think especially in this society, as mentioned, and maybe I didn't mention it, but the majority of people, householders that the Buddha spoke to, were Brahmins. The majority were Brahmins. And they had the fortune of having money and leisure time to practice. And that's why he would encourage them to practice all three trainings. And I look at us as in that same situation. The majority of us have it pretty good. And we do have time to practice. We're not having to work 7 days a week at 3 and 4 jobs. The majority of us don't have to do that. And so there really is no excuse not to practice if we're sincere about this training. That's about it. That's what I have to say. So I'm curious to hear any of your comments or questions. Not that I can answer them, but you can ask them.
Did householders ever do the rains retreats in your research, or is that something specifically for the monastic community?
The only thing I found that they did is, and I wish I could find the quote, I had it here and I can't seem to find it. The Buddha said when and I don't remember which householder, had been practicing for quite a while, he said it would be very good for you now to develop your samadhi practice. It would be good for you on occasion to sit and sit with the Sangha and practice. but he didn't say anything about Rheims retreat or doing long retreats like what we do, many of us who are householders. So we're kind of this hybrid, you know, situation. But I was curious about the same thing. So far, I've not found anything. And Doug, do you know anything about that? So more research.
Yeah, it's an interesting question about householders in residential retreat.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that the little bit I know, it sounds like it was not even brought up in the Buddha's day. It's you became a monastic. He considered that the best way to, well, maybe the best way, the quickest way to achieve complete freedom. Anybody else? Okay, then you can all go home. I'm going to do a dedication of merit, speaking of merit. So may this practice and the time we spent together this evening, may any accumulation of merit by cultivating a mind of kindness and curiosity and wisdom, may it be given to all living beings everywhere. And may every living being, no matter where they reside or what kind of living being they are, all of us in this room and all creatures, great and small, may all of us achieve complete enlightenment and hopefully in this lifetime.